watching the Gators roll in.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday. It is the 6th of September, and we're very happy to have you. We made it through the first week of September. Congratulations, all. Whether you realize that we've done it or not, we've done it, and we thank you all very much. And I know it's a hectic week with kids going back to school and getting back into the rut, the groove of back to a normal, you know, everybody hopefully back in the office and all that good stuff. Or Heather just rolled her eyes. Your situation may vary. But anyway, welcome. We made it, and here we are. And we've got a great show coming up with a wonderful panel. I will introduce them in just a moment. Before I do, however, I do want to just remind you and or announce for the first time. I'm not sure which we're doing here, because I know we had talked about this. We had scheduled a DEI panel that was going to happen over at the Linda, and that was the week of the assassination attempt and the change in the presidential ticket and the convention and all of that. We decided that it was probably, if we wanted to keep our hair, to actually move it to a time that would hopefully be a little less crazy. So we did that, and we moved it. Well, we have a new date for it, and it is Thursday, September 19th. It's Thursday, September 19th. So I believe that is 2 weeks from yesterday is September 19th. And we are going to do it at the Linda. It runs from 9 to 11. The topic, diversity, equity, and inclusion. We have an incredible panel lined up. Let me just tell you who is on the panel. Alfredo Medina Jr., who is Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the at Bennington College, also previously held that position at the University at Albany. Anzala Alozi is a Director of Energy and Climate Equity at NYSERDA. Jay Holly is Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion and Belonging at Together for Youth. Nick Rangel is a wonderful regular panelist, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, and Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. So, these are amazing people, and we will be talking about a very difficult subject, one that is certainly an election issue for many reasons, and we will talk about it in depth on Thursday, September 19th. If, for those of you who already have tickets, you're set. For those of you who don't, we want you. This is a fundraiser for the radio station. The money will go into the lockbox for October. That's not far away, obviously. We need a lot of money for the lockbox. This is a great way of doing it. We love doing these shows, and we hope that you can help out in any way possible. We're asking for a $75 pledge or more for each admission, and your name will be at the guest list at the door. No ticket necessary, but every pledge counts toward our October lockbox, helping us get to a great start for our fun drive. So, again, it's Thursday, September 19th. Doors open at 8:30. Show runs from 9 to 11. DEI is the subject, diversity, equity, and inclusion. All of the questions will come from the floor. So anything that you have on your mind, anything you would like to talk about, a great group of panelists and a wonderful group of listeners who will be in one room to talk about this very important issue. So we welcome you to do that. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org, 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 and find out more information. I'll remind you more about that a little bit later, but in the meantime, you have a chance to check in and get your tickets for that event. We would like to sell out the place, so that would be very fun. All right, let me introduce the group to you. A reminder, you can always be a part of the program. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Judith Enk is with us, former EPA regional administrator, president of Beyond Plastics, faculty member at Bennington College. Hello, Judith Enk.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. Jim Hendler is here, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Joe.
CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, is here. Hello, Heather.
Good morning.
Really nice to have you.
Thank you. It's a morning of great, great fall beauty and lots of deer in my yard.
I know. The deer, and they're, you know, they got the horns now, and they're, yep. They're handsome creatures.
Well, one jumped the fence into the fenced area outside my house where I let my dogs out in the morning. And they're always raring to go because they're squirrels and they want to chase the squirrels. So it was, I didn't think anything was different. And I let him out and there was a deer in the yard. And the poor thing, it jumped in, but it couldn't figure out how to jump out. So they're chasing it around in circles, didn't catch it. And then eventually it just flung itself against the fence and somehow detached the top of the chain link and got through. And the dogs were just, you know, sniffing at the fence for about 4 hours.
Honest to God, I had this happen with a cow.
Really?
Yeah. And you don't think
you had a cow chase a deer in your yard?
Had a cow not jump over the moon, but jumped over a fence, could not get out, and just ripped the hell out of it.
Yeah.
You can still see remnants of the disaster, but it's
so at least it wasn't a cow chasing a deer in your yard because that would be so weird.
No. Yeah. No. But imagine letting the dog out into the fenced in area. And seeing a cow.
Oh, one of mine is a herding dog. He would feel the urge to herd the cow into something. And in my instance, it would be the house, which is, not good.
Yes, great fun. All right, let me, again, did we get everybody?
No,
Aaron.
Listen, I can't follow that. I can't top that, so just fine, whatever. Hi, good morning, everyone.
We could share this cow, Aaron, you don't know. Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pacitti. Good morning, Aaron, how are you?
Doing well.
Really good to have you all here. All right. Let's get started on what is happening in the world. And all right, Hunter Biden pleads guilty in tax case. This is, I think, an interesting story. The guilty plea now exposes President Biden's son to a likely outcome that once seemed unthinkable, significant time behind bars. Hunter Biden pleaded guilty on Thursday to 9 federal tax charges in Los Angeles after telling his legal team that he refused to subject his family to another round of anguish and humiliation after a gut-wrenching gun trial in Delaware 3 months ago. The dramatic development signaled the final stages of a fraught investigation of more than 5 years into the period when Mr. Biden bankrolled his uncontrollable drug and alcohol addiction by leveraging his last name into lucrative overseas consulting contracts and not paying taxes. This was a plea without a deal, a unilateral decision by defense lawyers persuaded they could not prevail in the trial and not part of a settlement that included a reduced punishment. Mr. Biden, speaking in a low and clipped voice as he sat at the defense table, repeated the word guilty 9 times as Judge Mark Scarsi ticked off each of the charges. He will remain free on bond until a sentencing hearing in mid-December. The plea now exposes President Biden's son to a likely outcome that seemed unthinkable just a year ago when his lawyers were on the cusp of a no-prison plea agreement. Significant time behind bars. He now faces a maximum prison sentence of up to 17 years or a fine of up to $1.3 million on top of the possible sentence of 25 years after being convicted of lying on a firearms application in Delaware in June. It does appear, at least for now, that he is banking on a parental executive reprieve as Hunter Biden's team appeared in court listening while every word of his 56-page criminal indictment was read back to him. The White House press secretary told reporters on Air Force One, it's still very much a no when asked if the president planned to pardon his own son. Heather.
So, boy, first I will say, and I, you know, purely for scientific research purposes, I flip back and forth between MSNBC and Fox. And when I was watching Fox yesterday in my office, they were freaking out because supposedly Biden was going to enter an Alford plea, which is like a nolo contendere. It's like you're pleading because you know that it's very unlikely that you'll succeed defending yourself, but it's not an allocution of guilt necessarily. You still get sentenced as if you were guilty, but you don't have to actually, you know, on the record say, yes, I did this. Yes. You know, you basically are saying, I know that I'm not going to win. So it's no contest, basically. And it's not permitted everywhere. New York does permit Alford pleas, but they were freaking out because, the prosecution didn't know anything about this. And it does require the prosecution to consent, and they did not consent. So he then changed his approach and decided to plead straight up guilty and allocute to the underlying facts. But that tells you that, you know, obviously they did not want to move forward with the trial. I think the last trial was fairly excruciating for the family, setting aside the fact that, you know, at the time his father was running for president. Obviously, he's trying to just stave off any additional pain. Doing it without... you know, any promise as to sentence is obviously those are some big dice that you're rolling. He's high profile. And I think the thing that comes to mind for me is in both of these cases, both the gun case at lying on an application for a gun and this case, the sentencing judge has to be very careful, because if you give him a super light sentence, it looks like it's because he's a high profile person, he's got money, and we don't want a justice system where people are treated better because they are wealthy. Now, I know you're laughing, but...
I was going to say, unless they're former presidents, but we won't go there.
But I think it's really important. The credibility of the justice system is really important. Yeah. And if the judge is doing their job, they need to take that into consideration, which means probably not going to get off with just a slap on the wrist. Yeah. You have to balance that out against, do you really want the justice system to be penalizing someone for something that other people would not be getting even charged? I think on particularly the lying on the gun. Yeah. You know, do you really, is it because the person is high profile? And then it looks like the justice system is weaponized for political purposes. So there's a really interesting balance that needs to be struck. I'd be very curious to see what happens in both of these cases. I mean, my experience as a public defender and working in the district attorney's office, I don't think he's going to do any significant time. Maybe he'll do home confinement with probation or something like that. Then you can kind of hang. You know, he's got to stay sober. He's got to stay on track out there. But I'd be afraid that there'd be a temptation to sentence him to incarceration, even though he's not a threat to society, right? Like, what would be the purpose of that? So anyways, that's my very long-winded answer. Sorry.
Not at all. Judith Enck.
Well, I think the saddest people yesterday were not only the Biden family and Hunter Biden, but the producers and the bookers at Fox News. Because what are they going to talk about for the next couple months? They have really, the right-wing media has latched on to this like it is the crime of the century. It is a crime. I mean, Hunter Biden failed to pay $1.4 million in federal taxes over a three-year period. He has since paid the taxes. He's got separate problems with the felony gun violations in Delaware. And a lot of this happened when he was really struggling with drug and alcohol addiction. You know, this is one of the many, many problems when people have drug and alcohol problems. They don't pay their taxes on time. But he was making a lot of money to, you know, as a political consultant, to have that high a tax rate. I have to admit, I'm completely disinterested in this story. However, I did pay attention yesterday, and two things stood out to me. One is President Joe Biden has said consistently he's not going to pardon his son. And I think that's the what he believes today. But, man, this is, you know, this is a guy who is all in on his family. And this is going to be hard for him in his final days of the presidency. And I don't know if there'll be sentencing and if there's jail time known by mid-January or not. But the second thing that really struck me is how common tax evasion is in this country. And yet only 363 people were sentenced for tax fraud in the whole country last year. That does not suggest that the IRS and the Justice Department are particularly active in terms of enforcing the tax laws on the country. And if they are really looking for the big fish, Hunter Biden is certainly high profile, and you need to make the point that no one is above the law, cough, cough. But, you know, how about going after very large violators of the tax code? And I would like a House congressional investigation on why only 363 people were sentenced for tax fraud last year in the country. And this is according to the Sentencing Commission.
Aaron.
Yeah, so, yeah, I agree with Judith that this is, I think the bigger picture here is that Republicans have been using Hunter because it's just convenient as a political tool to try to place Joe Biden in the center of a family crime syndicate. They failed to, you know, find any evidence against the president, which would have discredited him in a reelection campaign. So since that failed, now the goal is to just to make the Biden family pay. And that serves a really important purpose in terms of discouraging people, particularly Democrats, from running for office. Because if you run for office, it's very clear that the Republicans have weaponized the judicial system to go after anyone and anyone for anything, no matter how weak the charges are. So, you know, if they're really concerned about tax evasion, start looking at, you know, how Wall Street traders pay their taxes. It would be a lot more lucrative for the IRS, and I think you would find a lot more criminal activity there than you would for what happened with Hunter Biden. So to me, to quote Abraham Lincoln, that this whole, both the gun charge and the tax evasion charge, are thinner than the soup made from the shadow of a starving pigeon.
Say that again.
These charges are thinner than the soup made from the shadow of a starving pigeon.
I like that. That should be on a pillow. I like it. Jim Handler.
Yeah, you know, I'm also of the yawning over the story part. I do understand some of these implications. But I do think one of the most interesting things in here is, despite every effort the Republicans made to tie Joe Biden to the case, nothing has emerged, nothing in these pleas, nothing in the trials. It's very clear that Hunter was taking advantage of the name. I will point out that there are other children of other presidents who have done significantly worse and don't seem to be being targeted by the Republicans. For example, a $2 billion, $2 billion, $20 billion, whatever, Saudi deal for the children of one of the former presidents who's currently running for re-election. So again, I just have a, you know, it just feels very much like everyone said. It was a story that only had legs because of politics. Those politics are now significantly less important. You know, in the best case for, well, best, worst, whichever way you look at it, even if Biden were to pardon Hunter, which I doubt personally he would do just because of his personal ethics, that, you know, it won't even happen before the election. So it's not an election issue except as speculation. So, you know, I really see it's become a non-issue. I looked at the stories today and was like, you know, this one just seems to be one that just ties a bow around something that the Republicans have been trying to do for a long time. And I agree with Judith, you know, now the right wing is going to have to find something else to go after.
So I have a couple observations. One, first, the idea that the fact that there are only 300 and some odd sentences for tax fraud to me is not at all surprising because the vast majority of those cases are resolved civilly. There's never a criminal approach to it that, you know, they're routinely audited. I mean, I have members who have gone through these endless audits where as soon as the audit ends, they're audited again. And they very rarely are they criminally prosecuted because in the vast majority of cases, there's an agreement reached by the person who maybe underpaid or didn't pay their taxes, which is very different than not reporting income at all. And that's, I mean, in this instance, he didn't report income at all. That same thing is true of virtually every person who's arrested for felony drug sales. I mean, they don't, you know, sell the drugs, you know, and not report the income and then get prosecuted for tax fraud. It's
very 1099.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so that's, I mean, I'm not at all surprised that that number is low because there's the goal of the system is for people to actually pay what they owe. Right. The other thing I wanted to say is it was funny hearing Aaron talk about weaponizing the justice system. I mean, there's another person who's used those exact same terms.
Well,
and that's one of the big problems here is you have it has to be credible. And, you know, if they had just given him a pass and not charged him with anything, I think there's an argument that it's because of his profile. And look, the president's son doesn't get prosecuted for this when ordinary people would now. But do ordinary people really get prosecuted for this? That's the other question. What? I mean, there's the history is rife with examples of high profile people not being charged with things. I mean, Elliot Spitzer comes immediately to mind. You know, there was a huge contingent of people who were very upset that he wasn't charged with violating the same law that he actually wrote. You know, so
well, he did resign his position as governor.
I would say
that's more significant than a couple of years in jail.
I don't know about that. I mean, the thing is resignation. I get it, elected official, but Hunter Biden wasn't an elected official, so he doesn't have the option of resigning. I don't think you should be able to get off the hook for a criminal prosecution just because you hold office and, you know, you have this other thing that you can do. I don't think that's fair either. So, but anyways, I digress. I think the argument could be made both ways.
Well, and I would like to throw in one other thing. You know, one of the things the Inflation Reduction Act and the Democrats have been fighting for a long time was to replace the huge amount of IRS agents who were let go under the Trump administration.
Yep.
And particularly the people who were let go were those who do go after the higher tax rates, so certain kinds of audits and things like that. And, you know, in many cases, you know, I think the other reason that you don't see the prosecutions is many of the tax laws get more and more ambiguous as the amount of money gets higher. So again, the not reporting is a very clear one,
right.
But you know, you look at I won't name names, but how does a super billionaire end up paying $0 in taxes without it being illegal? And the answer is because they can hire $1 million lawyer who can look at every single quote loophole unquote in the tax laws, take advantage of them, move the money to the places where, you know, instead of it showing up this way,
plus we tax income, not wealth, and you get to a point where you don't need to take income, right? You've got
enough. But you've got people whose salary is $30 million
a year. Much smaller group of people,
It's a smaller group of people, but it's if they were paying my tax rates, we would not be having economic problems in this country at the levels we do. And some of the things the Republicans are arguing for not that are too expensive, which I suspect we'll get to in some of our other stories.
Our panel has spoken. Let us take a break. When we come back, we will give you your opportunity. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this.
If you come down low, better take care. The moss gets mighty muddy when it rains.
41 minutes past 9 o'clock on the 6th day of September. We welcome your comments. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about Hunter Biden. A guilty plea from Hunter Biden yesterday on these tax charges. And we've heard from our panel. We would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to Bob, who says, I'm guessing that Biden will keep his promise to not pardon Hunter, but he hasn't said he won't commute his sentence. That would essentially accomplish the same thing without breaking the promise. Don't you think it depends on the outcome of the election?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of he's saying that now as just a line in the sand of like, well, this is where I am now. It's going to make me appear to be an ethical gun.
Trump, if Trump wins the election, I think Hunter Biden gets pardoned.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All bets are off
and
at
by
that
the way,
point.
If Harris wins, I think Hunter Biden gets pardoned, but not by Biden.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, okay, sure.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Not sure, but maybe.
It's an interesting. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
do you want to start a roundtable betting pool right now to see
if
he gets
pardoned? I think he gets. I think he gets pardoned either way, but commutation is a possibility too. I think Trump wins. He gets pardoned, or his sentence gets commuted, or something.
But also see what the sentence is.
Well, yeah, yeah,
sure,
yeah. I can't imagine it's going to be nothing, and I can't imagine that it's going to be huge.
25 years
right. It's going to be something that passes the sniff test for equity, I hope, anyways.
Pamela says, I think Mr. Biden should be sentenced consistently according to the average sentencing for these crimes in similar cases. He has met most of his obligations, has saved the government the cost of going through a full trial, and has not been obstructive. These factors should count in that sentencing, says Pamela. Then there's Michael. Leona Helmsley and Martha Stewart also failed to pay taxes but made lots and lots of money. Should Hunter Biden receive a harsher sentence than them? If so, why?
Martha Stewart did time.
Yeah, and she was also convicted of insider trading, which is different than just avoiding paying taxes. So
I think she was charged with insider. I feel like what she was sentenced on was the tax element, but I was on Nantucket one time in Bartlett Farm, which is this big, huge, beautiful farmer's market. And Martha Stewart was at the counter across from me, buying flowers. And my goodness, she is an absolutely stunning woman in person. Stunning.
Well, and has remained relevant in our media consumption for decades.
Yeah, I mean the stuff that she does with Snoop is so funny. Yes. It's just awesome to watch.
Still one of the most popular spokespeople in America in her mid-80s, you know.
And when I saw her on Nantucket, I mean, it was after she had served her time, but she was still, I mean, she was probably at least in her 60s and just, you know, so nice to everyone in the store. And I just remember walking away thinking, I like Martha Stewart, you know.
So, so as long as we're going off on the Martha Stewart.
Yeah, why not?
Go ahead.
I actually occasionally get invited to these weird events. They used to be called Friends of O'Reilly, and one of them Foos. And one of them was the science group. So I got invited with a group of scientists, and they have some special guests there. And the keynote speaker was, I can't pronounce his last name, Charles. It's a Russian last name. He was the creator of this little project called Microsoft Office. So he had a few dollars. And so he was talking about his summer vacation, which was 2 weeks in the Mir space station. But the interesting part was his then girlfriend was Martha Stewart, who gave an even more interesting talk about how she had learned to make interesting recipes that would be worth eating by astronauts in zero gravity so that he could have good food to take with him.
Wow, that's so a good girlfriend, about, right?
It's also a good business.
They're not exactly
too.
A normal, yeah, yeah. You know, yeah, not exactly your
nice
normal
trial
couple,
run,
but yeah.
Oh, why didn't that relationship last?
That killed a few minutes, Joe.
Yeah. Thomas writes to us and says, I voted for Joe Biden and will for Harris. However, as an American, it is vital that high-profile people who break the law get prosecuted. We can go on and on and on with numerous people that should be looked at, but the bottom line is this man brought it on himself. And that is from Thomas. All right, let us change the subject as we get this in before the top of the hour break. And we talked about, for the first hour of yesterday's program, we talked about the tragic school shooting in Georgia and talked about the 14-year-old who was charged and the four people who were killed, two teachers, two students. Yesterday, there was a twist in all of this as the father, Colin Gray, was charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter, two counts of second-degree murder, and eight counts of cruelty to children. An official said the charges stemmed from him, quote, knowingly allowing his son, end quote, to have a weapon. Colin Gray his son is accused of killing two teachers and two students. And now the father, Colin, charged with second-degree murder in connection with the deadliest school shooting in the state of Georgia. In addition to two counts of second-degree murder, Mr. Gray also charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter, eight counts of cruelty to children, according to a statement. There's not a lot of detail in other than we know that he is indeed in custody at this time. So I think some of the obvious questions that I have yet to see answers for, but they may be out there. I just haven't seen. I know this was a troubled family, and there was a lot of a lot of dysfunction within the family, a lot of going back and forth. So as to exactly what happened and what led to the specific charges, I think that still a lot of that remains up in the air, other than there are those who within the family, within that family, say that the parents and especially the father have a lot to ask for. This week, the boy's aunt told the Washington Post that the teen had been begging the adults around him for mental health support in recent months. If he didn't have a damn gun, he wouldn't have gone and killed anybody.
So, you know, I think yesterday's panel focused a lot on the gun issue, and I think that's absolutely critical, and you know, you don't even get into these stories without these kind of weapons being available. But I think there's an interesting question here. There was a Times Union editorial Sunday, I want to say 3 weeks ago, but it may have been longer, on, you know, we shouldn't, you know, why does charging the parents of the shooters do anything, right? And this was a very interesting case. Because in this case, the father clearly, in the details that have been published, right, there had been eviction a couple years ago where, you know, they found a lot of guns. The father said, you know, I don't want my son going into mental health because they're going to come after my guns. So, you know, I mean, this seems to be a case where, quote, family services, unquote, broke. And well, I think that this is something that I haven't really heard a lot about in this discussion, in general about gun violence and things like that, and particularly by the younger shooters, which is that people who are calling it a mental health issue are really not typically calling it a family issue. And in some cases, you could say, okay, the parents knew nothing about it. But in most cases, the parents knew something was going on. And the problem is, you know, I actually looked around at some of the New York rules and things like that. You know, if I thought my kid was going to do something bad, there's almost no cheap, free, easy service that I can go to get us some family counseling. I can report them to the police, but that's obviously, you know, typically not what a parent would want to do. There's school counselors and things who we can tell stories about how good or bad they are. But, it, you know, again, that's not a family thing. So it just struck me that all of these shootings, all of these parent involvements, all these things actually are showing another problem. It's not really always the mental health of the shooter, which I know is something that we get yelled at when we talk about. But I think the stability of the family, the dysfunction, the fact that dysfunctional family has so little political support for making it easier for those kind of things to be identified and dealt with. And I mean, I don't mean dealt with at a criminal level. I mean dealt with at a help level. So by the time it becomes an abusive relationship and someone is hurting someone else, then it goes over to the police. By the time somebody does a shooting, but during that time where you know there are problems, there's really very little social service offered at the level that's needed.
I couldn't agree more. I do think, however, that the one is that, you know, we talk about the mental health system. So obviously there's this family, the family court system, the family system that is also very much broken and has no better results really in helping these situations. We detailed yesterday on the show a lot of the steps that were taken or believed to have been taken with this youngster. You know, you call for somebody and then they say, well, we can get back to you in 3 months. And then, you know, meanwhile, all of this just gets pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And there are active threats being made as this is going on. So, I mean, that's obviously a real concern. And so I agree with you entirely, but like, we can figure two things out at one time, right? I mean, especially if they're intertwined.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, but in this case, this individual had previously been investigated for posting threats to shoot up a school. I mean, if, you know, I think, like, the arguments, I think all the laws, red flag laws, all of those things have merit. But here, if the argument is, well, I didn't want him to go to mental health services because that would trigger some action against my weapons, well, aren't you having the inverse effect then of the reporting, like parental reporting? If you're going to be punished individually for reporting, now I'm not a gun owner. But why is that a choice? Well, it shouldn't be, but, right. But that's the father's argument in this.
Right.
That,
no,
you know,
I understand. Right. It just seems like an odd thing to give you a choice for, that we don't have to turn in your weapons because you've chosen that you don't want to go with the mental health route.
It shouldn't be.
It's even worse than that. The FBI went to the home last year because they saw some social media postings that the shooter was
I think it was the State Bureau, but go ahead.
Law enforcement.
Yes.
Went to the home, confronted the father because the son, at the time 13-year-old, was posting on social media about interest in school shootings. The father not only shoos them away, but after law enforcement was at the house, the father purchased his son an automatic rifle as a gift. I mean, I think that's why the father is charged here, and it's only the second time that parents are charged related to children doing violence at schools and various shooting. And, you know, I just think we need to do something to change the status quo. And if it's having parents held accountable if they knowingly knew about the potential of their kid shooting up the school, I think it's a reasonable path for DAs to take. But, you know, and I certainly agree that our social safety net in this country is filled with holes, especially for people without economic resources who need mental health support. But that is the case in many countries around the world. And the United States has more gun shootings, gun violence, than any other country. It's really not about mental health. It's about the guns, and it's about the volume of the guns. But, and after Columbine, the United States banned assault rifles, and that ban lapsed, and the gun incidents went up. So it's fairly obvious what needs to happen, but the political power of the NRA prevents Congress from acting responsibly.
Yeah, I think yes, correct, Judith. I wholly agree with you, but there are certainly some very sensible regulations we can have about access to guns, particularly high-powered assault rifles, automatic weapons, and so on. But we're not getting rid of guns in this country, so that begs the question of, well, what practical steps can...
But what about assault weapons?
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that, like, there are simple measures, but so if you don't have assault, that's not going to get rid of guns in the U.S. It gets rid of one type. But I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think you just take this logic of, well, if we're going to hold the parents legally accountable, why don't we hold law enforcement legally accountable, that if they had information that this person was likely to do something, then law enforcement should be held accountable. Why don't we hold gun manufacturers accountable, saying your product was used in a purpose that it was not intended for? So there, since we're not going to get rid of guns, there are ways we can hold individuals and organizations legally accountable for what people do with their products. I know those legal changes are that's a huge uphill climb, but you know there's precedent for this, and that was the RAVE Act that was passed in 2001, where concert venues could be held legally accountable if law enforcement caught drug use and drug sales happening on their premises. So guess what happened after that law was passed? It was very difficult to buy or use drugs in concert venues because there were security all over the place. So, I mean, people just did it outside. It's not like it stopped drug use. But the logic of that law is that you just work your way up the ladder in terms of holding organizations that have greater responsibility legally responsible for things that happen with their product or on their premises, and you will start to see behavioral changes.
Well, right now, gun manufacturers have immunity, so they are not held accountable. And we can definitely, you know, do some modest reforms like safe storage of guns and universal background checks. But I still come back to the issue, why do people, civilians, need assault weapons? Sure. You don't need it for hunting. And the only thing I've heard when I've listened really carefully is people say, like, it's more exciting when they do shooting practice. Well, maybe they need to give up that excitement when they're doing shooting practice in exchange for the broader good of not having children killed at schools. I'm just stunned that we did have the ban for years, and then it lapsed, and no one has the political power to get it reinstated.
We have to take a break, but do you want to get that in quick?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Actually, I can't get it in quick. Let's
okay,
go to break.
All right, so we'll. Good, because we have a whole other hour. Okay, we'll take a break and we'll be back. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome your letters. We have a lot of those to read. We'll get to those. Jim and others will talk more on this issue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I'm going to write that down. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. And we have an incredible panel. Judith Enck is with us, Jim Henler, Heather Mulligan, and Aaron Pasitti. We were talking right before the break about the issue of Colin Gray, the father of the Georgia school shooter, the shooting suspect, who has been charged in that case with a murder as well as other charges. Jim, you were about to make a point before we went to break.
You know, I think it was that we had been talking about the whole gun control, et cetera, and there had been a comment made about, you know, people say it's more fun and things like that. I want to say, Judith, you haven't, luckily for you, gone diving into the ugly parts of the internet. Right. You go down to 8chan and the thing. And again, I've had students who study mis and disinformation. So we do, unfortunately, have to read this stuff. And I mean, these are people who say we want to own these guns because when the government comes to take, you know, when they try to replace us white people with, you know, non-whites, we want to have our we're going to need our guns because. You know, they're going to be supported by the government, et cetera. I mean, so while I do agree the NRA power, I think we have a tendency to overestimate the NRA power in the gun thing and really miss the fact that it's this single issue, what we would now call a MAGA voter, although they've been around for a long time. It's just that now they have a way to talk to each other. They do it. It's the survivalists. It's things like that. These people have significant money, significant resources, and they, you know, and they're also part of this story. And their local police believe the same things they do in many cases and things like that. So I think the gun story in America is a lot more complicated than that the NRA is a powerful lobby, because there are powerful anti-gun lobbies, too. And, you know, the overall population surveys make it very clear that, quote, common sense gun laws, unquote, could go through. But you have these people who are absolutely crucial to some of the particular politicians in their areas, especially with gerrymandering and things like that. So I think the gun issue politically is much more complicated than people have a tendency to make it.
I think that a ban on assault weapons is not an unreasonable first step in the right direction.
It'd be nice.
But I think culturally we have a problem where it is now, I'm not going to say acceptable, but it is a response to bullying, a response to being unhappy. Somehow the solution is to shoot up a school. And that, I don't think, is the case anywhere else in the world. I just, it culturally doesn't seem to be something that is outside of the U.S. I mean, you do have examples of people committing awful, like there's the guy, I think, in London who set fire to the hotel that had immigrants in it, you know, doesn't have access to assault weapons in London, but he still has access to, you know, accelerants and was able to still to try and do something pretty awful. I mean, there are definitely people who need to be recognized and intervened with earlier. But going back, I mean, do something. Yeah. Like, ban assault weapons. At least do that. I just, and it should be national. It can't be where, it's banned in New York, but I can go to Ohio and get one. You know,
and,
it's
you
just.
Know, the argument against that is, and I'm not agreeing with that, but then they say, well, it's a slippery slope because first it's assault weapons.
Well, then everything it's, then is it's a slippery guns. Slope. And then there's always something else you can do, right?
And then it's fishing rods. And, then, you know, it's like, shut up. This
well,
is
and you know, and you pointed out yourself. Really frustrating thing about this is we had an assault ban, assault weapon ban. It was clearly effective. The data was incontrovertible. And it just got turned into a political issue that had nothing to do with killing people, had to do with all of these other forces and being able to build a differentiator between one party and another and, you know, individual rights, quote unquote, the whole reinterpretation of the Second Amendment by the Supreme Court. Oh, God. So, you know, I mean, it really is a complicated issue. I think if you just, you know, could have a national vote on should we put controls on assault weapons, it would pass overwhelmingly.
I mean,
the problem is it's not the national vote. You don't get a national vote on that. You
no,
get
this is something Congress should do. It should not be an executive order. It should be done by Congress. It should be passed. And I think that, you know, they should be held accountable, too. Yeah. I think that if you, again, if you polled it,
nice.
I think if you polled it, right, most people would say, yeah, no need for these. And if really you need to have that fun, I mean, maybe have a controlled setting where someone can go into a range and use an assault weapon, you know, whatever.
Rent it out or
something.
Or go skydiving.
Yeah. Right, that's exciting.
If you need a thrill that intense.
Stamp collecting.
Not thrilling at all. Maybe to some. Maybe to some.
A lot of us love it. I mean, I keep on going back to what Malia DeMont said the other day as a person in the military. He said, look, we have our weapons, and then at the end of the day, we lock them up.
Yeah.
Like, we don't go back to our barracks or our homes with them. We lock them up.
Hmm.
That's what the military does.
Right.
So I that doesn't seem to be a stretch.
Well, in Israel, you know, people often make a comparison to Israel, saying, hey, look at Israel. They don't ban these guns, and they don't have these problems, so it's clearly not the guns. But in Israel, you can't get a gun unless you had previously served in the military, are on reserves, or you go through this very complex process. Two, the guns can never be left alone. It's really interesting. You go out to, you know, a nice sunny day, you go down to the Dead Sea, and there'll be one person standing there with, you know, the 15 guns, because those guns have to have somebody watching. You can't even just leave them in your car or things like that. And the penalties for misuse of guns, way higher than here. So, you know, again, it is possible to control gun ownership in a way that, you know, makes sense, but it's very cultural, and our culture, it's unfortunately this so-called Second Amendment issue. And again, I point to the fact that people think that conspiracy theories and these, you know, quote, crazies, unquote, on the internet are small groups. We're talking very large numbers of people. We're talking some of whom have a lot of money. We're talking about people who live in gerrymandered districts who can make the difference between whether the ultra-conservative candidate or the conservative candidate gets elected. And, you know, what is one of those issues? If either of those two guys says word one about gun control, they're out. And so when we say Congress should do it, yeah, of course Congress should do it. But it's really hard for some of these Congress people to do it because of this. So I think there's a much deeper issue here. And obviously gun laws and obviously common sense things should happen. But I think that there's a real tendency to simplify it by just saying it's this one lobby that has a lot of power. There's
a lot of factors. They have a huge amount of influence. I mean, two things can be right at the same time.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not arguing they don't have a lot of influence. But, for example, if you look at the number of NRA members who are in favor of common sense gun control,
it's
very
high. Majority.
If you look at the NRA funders, which is mostly the gun manufacturers, things like that, it's a very different story. So, I mean, I do agree, but, I mean, there's other lobbies that have as much or more money than NRA, not necessarily on the gun issue per se, but which would go with the gun issue. But, again, it's that it's a very deep political issue, and I think people tend to simplify it.
All right. We have a ton of letters, so I want to get to those in the time here that we have. One is from Erica. At what point are we going to recognize that not every adult makes a good parent? If other adults in the community see that a child is being abused or neglected, why isn't there a way to make sure that child gets the help they need in spite of what a terrible parent decides? I realize we are in a divisive society where sometimes strangers can act out of spite or bad information, but what are we doing here? Just another reason to be against forced birth. Then we go to Julia, who says the lack of a system to help families in New York State for difficult teens is deplorable. If my husband and I weren't on the same page to spend our limited resources and a huge effort in finding any sorts of help, our child would be an angry and destructive man. We finally found support, but it broke our bank, and we depended upon the monetary love and support of multiple families to help us. Our child is now 27 years old, mature, developing his life with pride. We did the right thing, but 10 years of searching was traumatizing to the entire family. Susie writes, an underlying problem leading to our high level of gun violence is selfishness. Too many people are unwilling to give up their desire to have assault weapons, even though the availability of them is killing children in our schools. Russ writes, I want to know why the 14-year-old is being tried as an adult. Yeah. Is it because he used a gun that was built to be used by an adult? That didn't make him an adult, did it? He's just 14 years old. Just because he did an adult thing doesn't make him one. An adult does not attend high school as a student. The father being charged makes sense to me, and the son needs to get some kind of attention, but being charged as an adult and subject to the legal consequences of adults is wrong. He is still a kid. Then we check in with Kathleen. I agree with the panelists that we need more mental health support and social service for everyone, but especially children and families. But accessing mental health will likely always be slow, including finding a provider, screenings, etc. People who have an urge to harm themselves and others who have immediate access to guns don't have time to get through that process, even if they do have access to mental health care. The guns are the immediate problem. Then Carolyn writes, the relentless use of the term mental health as the reason or cause of these shootings further stigmatizes mental health. It's just another way of trying to dismiss it as a crazy person one-off versus a systemic family societal issue.
I think that was the point I wanted to try to make, The letter writer does it better. So
yes.
Thank you.
Let's see. We go to final letter that we'll go to this morning on this subject. John says, being a child of the 60s, I think that maybe it's time for sane young people to start to demonstrate against the gun industry. Demonstrating at gun manufacturers, demonstrating at gun shops, demonstrating at their state representatives' offices, and demonstrating at NRA offices nationwide, and not letting up until something changes, which is certainly the work that the students from Parkland and other shootings have been doing over the last several years. Exactly that. Harleen writes, teachers throughout the country should go on strike and refuse to go to school to teach unless there is a total ban on assault weapons. Hmm. Parents throughout the country should refuse to send their children to school unless there is a ban on assault weapons. All right, we'll hold there.
Joe, I will say one of the scariest things I read in this whole thing in a certain weird way is one of the students who was interviewed out on the football field said, you know, this is the fifth time this month we've done this. We didn't realize it was real. I mean, that's what we've come to in America, where are getting active shooter drills instead of us banning guns.
And 6 weeks, right? 6 weeks of school that they had been in, something like that. So in a relatively short time of that many drills, that certainly helped. All right, it's jobs report time. I hope you're as excited as we all are. U.S. jobs report is out for the month of August. Aaron Vecitti is in, and we are ready to hear about employers adding 142,000 jobs in August and what that means.
So the the jobs report over the past year has been becoming increasingly important because the economy is at a turning point where inflation has been coming down from its summer of 22 high, and now we're starting to see some weakness in the job market. So, yeah, employers added 142,000 jobs in August. The unemployment rate ticked down from 4.3% to 4.2%. Wage growth ticked up from 3.6% to 3.8%. So for all intents and purposes, it's a pretty good jobs report. It's not the blistering job gains the economy experienced during the very long and protracted rebound from COVID. And it's probably exactly what the Federal Reserve wanted to see. The Fed has been raising interest rates since 2022. And the whole point of that interest rate hike campaign was to, soften economic growth, soften hiring, to put downward pressure on inflation. That's largely happened, where Jerome Powell, in his big speech in Jackson Hole a couple weeks ago, mentioned that, with the unwinding of COVID-related anomalies, the expiration of a lot of stimulus programs, that inflation's coming back down to the Fed's 2% target, and now they're going to turn their attention to making sure that the job market remains strong. So adding 142,000 jobs is enough to keep the unemployment rate constant, so that's a good sign. You're starting to see, employers with some softening of demand. The hires rate has gone down. The number of workers who are voluntarily quitting their job is starting to go down. So you're starting to see the red-hot labor market that existed from, 2021 up until 2023 start to cool off. And the Fed's biggest challenge now is how to lower interest rates at a pace that will keep unemployment at its, again, historically low levels without triggering an increase in inflation. So the Fed's in a unique spot because it looks like they're going to be successful in executing what they've called a soft landing, which is bringing inflation down without triggering a recession. The problem is that this is happening in an election year, in a very contentious election year. So the Fed's going to come under very increased scrutiny and probably a barrage of misguided insults from Trump about, well, the Fed's only lowering rates to help Kamala Harris win. And that's not true. The Fed's been telegraphing that they've been planning on lowering rates for quite some time. So their next meeting is September 17th, and then they'll have their press conference on September 18th, where they will most likely announce a quarter percentage point decrease in interest rates. I don't think the jobs report is weak enough to warrant the half point decrease some economists were expecting. So, the fact that the unemployment or the fact that the employment rate, the fact that the employment report came in soft is actually a good sign because the economy is maintaining a steady but low unemployment rate, we're not generating jobs that that are likely to increase inflation.
Well said. Do I get extra CLE credit for listening to that? I think I was trying to listen to Bloomberg this morning and their analysts, and it was really funny because one of them said, well, this is a continuation of a trajectory, and because it's these numbers are sort of lagging indicators, it means the Fed must cut 50, you know, basis points, versus the other one saying, well, this is, you know, probably it's only going to be a quarter percentage point cut because the numbers are looking pretty strong. You know, so one said positive, one said negative. Yeah. And I feel
just
like you kind of covered
Aaron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You covered it very well.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Judith. I should that should be my motto.
Yeah. I did have a little conversation with Aaron before we came on today about some of the data and things like that. You know, I think one of the things that does get lost in some of this job report stuff is you're lumping a whole lot of different data together and who's not getting jobs. You know, some of the stuff that's been reported is how much harder it is now for college students to get that first job. But, you know, that's across all college students, not across different majors, different ways of doing things. You know, it's not looking at the different kinds of jobs where the unemployment is. So, you know, somebody who had been working in field X that was, I don't know, high tech or something, isn't about to go become a construction worker, right? Those are different people. And, I mean, it may require long-term balancing. It may require some other things. But, you know, the sort of when you just say there were X jobs created and there were Y jobs open, it's really hard to do that. And he was telling me where I could find the data set if I wanted to actually put some numbers
There's huge variation in...
And that's clear.
Job growth by geography, by gender, by race, by education levels, by age. So, yeah, you know, when macroeconomists talk about these broad national trends, all of that detail gets lost. And I don't have that data handy to it, you know, to talk about, you know, the diffusion of jobs throughout the economy. The interesting thing is, though, is, you know, what matters coming up to an election isn't necessarily the level of unemployment or the level of inflation. It's the change.
Right.
So if unemployment is 10% and going down to 9%, that's a benefit for, you know, usually the incumbent.
Right.
If unemployment is 3.5% and going up to 4.2%, that's a disadvantage for the incumbent, in the incumbent in this case, the incumbent party, even though the level is a lot lower. So where the unemployment and inflation rate move over the subsequent months is going to be really important. And it looks like inflation and unemployment are both trending down. And that should be some tailwinds for Kamala Harris.
Well,
isn't the price of gas also on voters' minds a lot?
Sure. Yeah, right. Gas, groceries, all of those things are again, they're growing at a slower rate. Gas prices are coming down and groceries are growing at a slower rate.
We'll take a break and return with our panel after this for the BBC.
I hear thunder, I feel rain. I see lightning, I feel pain.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome you. We have a few moments left, about 15 minutes or so left with our group, and we thank you very much for being with us and for being a part of the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to get in. Panel at WAMC.org. All right. This story having to do with climate, the climate, as well as the U.S. election. From the New York Times, U.S. election looms over climate talks with China. Experts believe the outcome of the race for the White House could determine how ambitious China's climate efforts will be. If Vice President Kamala Harris wins, the U.S. is likely to keep pushing nations, including China, to set ambitious targets for cutting the greenhouse gases that are dangerously heating the planet. But if former President Donald Trump returns to the White House, he is expected to withdraw the United States from the global fight against climate change, as he did during his first term, and release any pressure China on to step up its efforts. As John Podesta, President Biden's climate envoy, wraps up 3 days of talks and Beijing, China's willingness to fight global warming could depend on the outcome of this fall's presidential election in the United States, according to the energy experts there in attendance. Judith.
Yeah, this is a high-stakes election on climate change, as we know, and that must have been a challenging 3 days for White House official John Podesta, because who will China be dealing with in January, February? We know it'll be a new president, but the differences on climate policy could not be starker. I'm glad he is talking to China, because combined, China and the U.S. together are the world's largest emitters of greenhouse gases, 40% just from the two countries, more from China than the U.S. So, as we prioritize our work, focusing on U.S. and China makes a huge amount of sense. China is moving away from fossil fuels pretty rapidly. Some of that is due to their slowing economy, but China's installed more solar panels than the United States. Almost two-thirds of the really big wind and solar projects in the world, two-thirds are under construction in China. 8 times more wind and solar planned than in the U.S. So, regardless of the outcome of the campaign, I think China is moving ahead faster and more comprehensively than the state of New York or the U.S. government. The diplomacy is important. Remember, Podesta went over there, and before that, John Kerry spent a huge amount of time in China. And we can't even, waste a couple months. The hottest summer in history was this summer, when the U.S. was part of the Paris Climate Agreement, which we are now. President Trump pulled us out. But the nations that signed on to the Paris Climate Agreement agreed to limit increase in temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And right now, we're at 1.2 degrees Celsius increase. So it's not an overestimation to say we are at the 11th hour. And if you don't follow global temperature trends, you can just look outside. I mean, just in the past year, the floods, the extreme heat, droughts, sea level rise, it's wildfire smoke because the forests in Canada and the Amazon are hotter and drier than ever before. I mean, the evidence is all around us, and we are running out of time. And so, one would think, well, maybe the U.S. negotiators should just, not negotiators, but representatives like John Podesta should just, wait till November to see the outcome. But literally every month matters here. And I, unlike what we hear from some conservative media commentators, China is actually transitioning to a clean energy economy quicker than the United States is.
Jim?
I don't know what to add to what Judith just said, except to say that, Judith, when you look at China's growing influence in other parts of the world, they are exporting some of that, but not at the level you'd expect. And the other thing is they are trying hard to make these transitions, but they also are still a large consumer of fossil fuels. So, again, the trade-off issues are not particularly easier there than they are here. It's just their commitment has been mostly economic. They are making a lot of money off of having made it cheaper to have non-fossil renewables, mm-hmm. and I wish we in the U.S. would be doing the same.
Yeah, there's the environmental impact, which Judith talked about, and the fact that this is going to require a concerted global effort to address climate change, because it's not going to be a single country you know, just deciding to lower their emissions, that solves it. But in addition to that, as Jim kind of alluded to, is there's, you know, the economic incentive is there too, and that needs to go hand in hand with the, you know, the diplomatic process where governments make concerted efforts to subsidize strategic industries that can help mitigate and lessen the effects of climate change, like investments and subsidies in renewable energies. China's been successful doing that largely to gain a, you know, competitive advantage against other countries. And I know part of the Inflation Reduction Act is designed to help kind of kickstart, you know, the U.S., you know, U.S. companies' role in all of that. So, you know, in my opinion, the country that that is able to switch as quickly and as, you know, without as much friction as possible to, you know, an economy largely based on renewable energies will be the world's next economic superpower. And that's not necessarily going to be the U.S. because they can harness extremely cheap and efficient fuel sources that benefit them economically and environmentally. So there's not really a trade-off in my mind about economic performance and improving the environment by mitigating the effects of climate change. I think there's a lot of complementarities that exist.
Yeah, the problem is the United States continues to subsidize fossil fuel drilling much more than renewables. And something that the Biden administration is bragging about, which makes my heart stop, is there's more fossil fuel development and export in the United States today than ever before. And, you know, there are a lot of elected officials who say that we need all of the above. And I make the case that we can't afford, either economically or public health-wise, all of the above, because the continued extraction and drilling and burning of fossil fuels is, you know, just devastating for the planet. And it is, unfortunately, the climate change issue is just viewed as like another check-the-box issue. It's, you know, there are a lot of important issues that candidates need to address. You know, housing, funding for education, public safety, and then climate is on the list. But if you look at what is happening physically all over the world, it is really serious. And the most depressed people you ever want to talk to these days is climate scientists, because they see the trajectory and many of them speak out, and it's not, the seriousness of the situation is not being embraced. And, you know, and there's all sorts of discussions about, well, how do you message this and what's the narrative, and you have to give people hope. That is all true, but the seriousness of the situation is profound, and saying you can, you know, slowly develop solar and wind and geothermal while you're also relying largely on fracked gas, is just not going to work. And in New York State, if you take away the very large-scale hydro projects in western New York built by Robert Moses and others, you know, over 50 years ago, if you take out the western New York large-scale hydro, New York State renewables is hovering only around 5%. And Governor Hochul has recently signaled that she is open to delaying the state's stated goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which like makes absolutely no sense, because since the goals were established, the climate situation has just gotten worse. And so while it's important to look at what's happening with China and the U.S., we have a lot of work to do at the state level. And I just think, you know, there are missed opportunities not to really, really accelerate not just renewables, but energy efficiency. And for people listening, the IRA tax credits on heat pumps and clean energy projects in your own homes and your own businesses are quite attractive and worth looking at, and maybe acting rapidly in case things change next year in U.S. government.
Can I just want to say a couple things. One, I think it's a global problem. I think we need global solutions, and I think it requires a commitment of all hands on deck. But I also think, you know, we need to be looking at interim measures that are cost effective, that are zero emission, like nuclear. And that has been roundly rejected by a lot of folks on the environmentalist side. I understand why, but that being said, it's zero emission, and it will provide enough baseload power that we don't run into problems with grid stability. You know, if we want to electrify the country, we need more generation, and right now the wind and solar that is coming online is not sufficient. And I think that was recognized by the controller. It's been recognized by the system operator. So, you know, in the interim, we need to not shoot ourselves in the foot. And face basically losing our economic underpinnings in New York because we're trying to be at the front edge of the curve and no one else is on board. There are solutions that are environmentally friendly that are available to us, but we can't reject them out of hand, including nuclear.
That's a whole other show.
Maybe.
I think that's something we disagree on.
Oh, I'm sure.
All right. Well, I think that's enough for this show. Then. That's fine. Very good group this morning. Thank you so much for all that you gave it. And I thank you so much for your comments. Have a beautiful weekend, all. Wonderful to have you all here. Judith Enck, Jim Hendler, Heather Mulligan, and Aaron Pacitti, and our thanks to them. And thanks to you for joining us and also for participating and writing as well. We will be back with more of the Roundtable.